Chapters of Life by Tuesday Lobsang Rampa, read for you by Blue Friend in beautiful BC. Chapter 11. You Write This. From Africa and India, from Australia and America, from countries all over the world, even from behind the Iron Curtain, comes letters, thousands of them. Questions, questions, questions. How to become a saint? How to use a mantra? Win the Irish sweepstake? How to have babies? How not to have babies? From Malaysia and Manchester, from Uruguay and Yugoslavia, the letters come. Questions and more questions. They usually fall into a certain pattern, so in this chapter, I'm going to reply to your more common questions. Keep calm, I'm most certainly not going to mention anyone by name. Question. I have read a lot of newspaper stories about you, and before buying any of your books, I thought I would write and ask if your books are true. Answer. I give a definite assurance that all of my books are true. All that of which I write is my own experience, and I can do all those things of which I write. Having given that assurance, let me say something else. My books are true, yes, but surely doubters cannot see the wood for the trees. What does it matter who I am? It is what I write that is important. Throughout the years, hordes of experts have tried to prove me wrong. They have failed. If I am a fake, where do I get the knowledge which others are now copying? All my books contain my own personal experiences. Nothing of it is the so-called automatic writing, beloved of the press. I am neither possessed nor obsessed. I'm just a person trying to do a very, very difficult task in the face of bigotry and jealousy. There are those in high places in India and elsewhere who could help, but who prostitute their religion to politics, and so, for political reasons, etc., they deny the truth of what I write. My books have done much to popularize Tibet and show people that Tibet is good and spiritual, yet none of this is taken into account. A stronger leadership might have enabled Tibet to avoid communist aggression, but no war was ever won by sitting on the fence and waiting to see which way the cat jumps. I receive thousands of letters from people who state that the truth of my books is self-evident, and I am proud, indeed, to be able to say that during the past 10 years I have received only 4 unpleasant or abusive letters. To return to the first paragraph of answer, let me add that it is most amusing to watch people squabbling over an author's identity and missing the whole point of his books. Poor old Shakespeare must think that his bacon is in the fire when he tunes in to some of the clever, clever people who know that Bacon wrote Shakespeare and that Shakespeare was Bacon. Who wrote the Bible? The disciples, their descendants, a gang of monks monkeying with the original scripts? What does it matter? Only the written word matters, not the name or identity of the author. So to answer the question, yes, all my books are true. Question. What is Nirvana? Why do Indians just want to sit down and do nothing and hope everything will come right for them in the end? Answer. The Indians do not think that at all. Nirvana is not the extinction of everything. It is utterly impossible to live in a void, in a state of vacuum. To live, one has to progress and develop. Consider, for instance, a car. First of all, a prototype is developed, and the car is tried and tested on the works testing track, and then, perhaps if it is a good quality car, sent to the mountains of Switzerland so that it may be tested both in Switzerland and in, perhaps, South American jungles. When the car is tested, certain faults develop and they can be eliminated. The purpose of the testing is to find out what is wrong and how to put it right. The same applies to humans. Humans have to be tested to find their weak points, and when the weak points are discovered, they can be overcome. That is being done all the time in the ordinary stages of evolution. You will agree that many new models of radios or cars or anything else, space rockets if you like, have faults. Later models are better because the faults have been eliminated. Nirvana is the stage in humans when faults have been eliminated. So the Indian and the erudite Easterner tries to overcome his faults. He tries to eliminate lusts and other quite interesting but harmful vices. You can say that he tries to live in a state of nothingness so far as vice is concerned. He wants nothing to do with vice. He's only interested in perfection. So instead of seeking to obtain loads of nothing, he tries to get rid of vice to leave more room for good. The old idea that nirvana is a state of nothingness where a person sits in mental and spiritual vacuity is false because there were wrong translations. Westerners think that they know so much. They try to put into concrete terms that which are mere abstract whispers. Nirvana, then, is the state wherein there is no evil, wherein one is like the three wise monkeys who see no evil, speak no evil, and do no evil. And when there is no evil, there is room for more good. Isn't that so? Question. Churches, missionaries, occultists, they're all out for money. They're all grabbers. Everyone wants to take from we poor people who have to work for an honest living. Now, you tell me, why should I give? Why should I bother with this old system of tithes? What is it going to do for me? Answer. Well, of course, if that's how you feel about it, there's little point in giving, because to give under conditions like this is much the same as going along to the local drink shop and trying to buy a pint of beer. You pay your money, and you get a certain concrete object in return. Giving from the spiritual sense is utterly, utterly different from that, and you just cannot mix the two forms of giving any more than, it is said, you can mix your drinks. But let's take a look at it a little more closely. All churches, all religions, realize the necessity of sacrifice. And in the very early days of Christianity, the Christian church realized that it was utterly essential to sacrifice, to give. In the early days of the church, and even now in most parts of the world, the Christian church demands a tenth of one's income. In England, they call it a tithe. And under Old English laws, ecclesiastical laws, of course, the church was entitled to a tenth of one's possessions, and one did not escape, even if one was not a churchgoer, because in England, years ago, one could actually be fined for not attending church. It was cheaper to go to church and listen to the words of wisdom, and then put some money in the collection box. If you evaded the words of wisdom, you had to pay more by way of fine. It was necessary that people gave a tenth of their possessions so that the church could be financed. There were priests of various kinds who had to be able to live. Someone had to pay them. So, as the churches were in power, they saw that Mr. and Mrs. Layman of the congregation did all the paying. It is essential that a person shall give before they can receive. Giving is like opening a door. If we do not open the door, we cannot admit those good things which are ready to come to us. If we're not prepared to give, then we cannot put ourselves in a receptive frame of mind. Actually, it is almost a problem in mechanics. In ages far beyond the Christian teachings, right at the dawn of history itself, the ancients believed in sacrifice because they did not go by the words of some self-styled scientist. They knew by actual experience that sacrifice was essential, and they sacrificed that which was of most value to them. They sacrificed a valuable creature, a ram, or in some instances a son. This was not done with the thought of cruelty, but with the thought of doing that which they considered would be pleasing in the sight of God. They thought that if they gave that which was of most value to them, it would show God the high value which they placed upon his pleasure. In the Far East, it is a custom to give very freely to those in need. The monk, with his bowl, is not just a beggar who's making himself a nuisance. The housekeeper or the woman of the house looks forward to giving to the monk who calls at her door. She will reserve the choice pieces of food for him. In many parts of India, where there's extreme poverty, people still keep aside food for a monk who calls, and this entails very considerable sacrifice, and it means that the people of the house are always on the hunger borderline. Yet the sacrifice is made willingly, and it is regarded as an honor if a monk calls at the door for food. The monk never has to ask. He just goes to the door, and the woman of the house will see him there. He will take him his bowl and will fill it with food. If she is very, very poor, she will put that which she has available in the bowl, and the monk will then go to perhaps three or four houses until he has enough. But those of the neighbors who are not called upon on that day will look upon it as a sign of disfavor, because they well know the merit to be derived from giving, particularly when giving means sacrifice. To digress again. Digression is one of my vices. Perhaps I'll get rid of that in Nirvana. It is most regrettable that many people take fright at the mention of money, although, actually, they love this stuff dearly. People expect to have the knowledge of ages without paying a penny for it. People expect a man to live throughout a very long life and to study all the time, and then to give away all that knowledge, all that he has gained, just for nothing, just so that he can get a good name, I suppose. But what happens if you want to train to be a doctor or an undertaker? That was unfortunate, wasn't it? Well, supposing he wants to train for anything, a man expects to have to pay for his knowledge. But when it comes to occult knowledge, everyone thinks they're going to be in on it for free. People forget that even those who have occult knowledge have to live, have to eat, have to have clothing, unless one is willing to be charged with indecent exposure. And if one is so busy learning and so busy teaching that one cannot earn a living, how is one to eat and clothe oneself? Sackcloth and ashes have gone out of fashion, and there seems to be a shortage of fig leaves. In the East, hermits do not earn money because there is not much money to be earned. People do not pay money for knowledge because most times there is no money with which to pay. They pay instead by service. The student provides the food and the clothes. The teacher provides the teaching. So they get on, each knowing and sharing the difficulties of the other, and each making allowances for the difficulties of the other. But in the Western world, where commerce reigns supreme, and where the pound sterling or the dollar is almost as good as God, money is all that matters. If you do not have money, then you are a fake or a failure. I will tell you that. I have had some remarkable experiences in this connection. However, perhaps that will come in another book when I write of my experiences with the press and a few jealous people in Germany and elsewhere. But now we must get back to our giving. You must give in order that you may receive. People ask for things, people pray for things, people pray for money, for health, it doesn't matter what it is. People pray that they may be given something. They never say what they may give instead, and it is a definite statement of fact that if one is always asking for things, one becomes as servile as a dog which merely asks for a pat from its master's hand. There is a definite occult law which says that you cannot receive unless you are first ready to give. Imagine that you are inside a room with the door and the windows shut, not locked, mind you, just pushed shut. If you wish, you can have the door made of thin paper and the windows also. Outside, piled in heaps with sacks all ready so it may be carried away, are jewels, riches worth a king's ransom and more. Outside, there are all the things you've ever dreamed of and wanted. Yet, if you could not push outside the paper door, you could not get at all those jewels which would be yours for the taking. If you will not make the first simple move, such as the symbolical pushing through the paper door, then you get nothing. Of course, this is symbolic. The act of opening the door symbolizes the act of giving, because unless and until one is ready to give, and until one has actually given with a good grace, one is shutting the door on any possibility of obtaining that which one wants. Not merely shutting the door, but locking it and barring it and pushing the furniture against it so that it cannot be opened. A person who is always asking for things and never giving is a dissatisfied person, a frustrated person, one who does not know his or her path in life, one who is searching but not too energetically for someone or something, one who is expecting others to do everything for him or her, but who is not willing to give even the slightest bit of energy in order that the matter may be speeded. Frequently a man or a woman will go to a metaphysician seeking a cure for some illness, perhaps an illness caused by an overexcited imagination. Well, in that case, the person seeking aid must be willing to give. Give of cooperation, for example, because a person cannot be cured until he or she cooperates. A person is wasting time in going to a metaphysician or any other kind of physician unless he or she is willing to cooperate. So many people say, in effect, well, if you cure me, it will be over my dead body, or words to that effect. You may say, as so many do, well, what have I got to give? I'm not rich. How can I give? I work hard for all I get. I'm not going to give to somebody who just sits around and makes wise remarks. The answer is, unless you are ready to give with grace, you're on the wrong path. You should be going backwards instead of forwards. For others who are really trying, the answer is that if you have no money, you can give in service. You can give in love and care to someone in need. If a good deed has been done to you, why not give by doing a good deed to someone else? We get nothing without paying for it, and we only get that for which we pay. You would not expect a luxurious motor car if you were prepared to only pay the price of a bicycle. There's such a lot of misunderstanding about give. People think, oh, they're always begging, they always want this, they always want that, they cannot be any good if they always want money. It's too easy to sit back and think, now what is there I don't want? What is there that I'm tired of? What can I get rid of to cut down on the load of rubbish? I know, I'll give away that old so-and-so because then I shall be justified in buying a better one for myself. Well, that is useless. That is a waste of time and is a mockery. It is wholly useless to give that which entails no sacrifice, that which occasions no loss. Some people are born to money. Then let them give money to advance some good cause. For no matter how much money a man may accrue during his lifetime, he cannot take a single cent out of this world. No person has ever succeeded in taking a material object beyond that which we term the veil of death. But every one of us takes the learning which we have gained through our experiences on earth. We take a distillate of all that we have absorbed. The more we learn, and the more we learn of what is good, the richer we are when we go to that which is truly the greater reality, whereas those who have sought only money in this life for their own glorification are nothing when they have no money with them. You may have power. Then with your power, help others, for your power is only lent to you to see how you will use it or abuse it. The man of millions, the leader of a country, they are not always good men. They are men who are given certain things in order that they may learn. Let us remember also that here we are as actors on a stage taking the dress which suits us for the moment, in just the same way as one takes theatrical properties to enable us to live out the part which is our lot. Remember also that the prince of today is the beggar of tomorrow, and the beggar of today is the prince of tomorrow. No matter how rich, how powerful one has been in past lives, when one comes to the last life in this round of existence, one comes to trouble, to lack of comfort, to hardship, and misunderstanding. That's because one comes to clear up the odd bits and pieces. One comes to pay all the debts that one owes. It is much the same as a person going away to a fresh house, but first having to clear up all the corners, all the cellars and the garrets of an old house. But let us deal a bit more with sacrifice. Abraham, Moses, and others, millions and millions of others, used sacrifice. Do you know what sacrifice means? Think of sacrament. Well, what does sacrament mean? Sacrifice, of course. Only by sacrifice could one secure the help of higher powers. But to sacrifice, you must do without something yourself, in order that someone else may benefit, in order that someone else may be helped. Sacrifice may call upon you to surrender something to which you are attached, but which would be a great blessing to a number of other people, or to help another person who has not had your good fortune. Are you a Christian? If so, you'll remember that the Bible says, "It is more blessed to give than to receive." To give opens up the wellsprings of our potential for good, opens up the gates whereby we may obtain that which we want to obtain. It is useless to give in order that you may be known as a holy person of good intentions. It is useless to have your donations for charity printed in the newspapers, because that would not be giving. That would be buying. You would instead, with your donations, be buying publicity for yourself. Let us think, then, that until we give that which entails some effort, some sacrifice, some loss, then we cannot receive anything which is worth having. So, isn't it worth giving? Question. People are stated to have various faults which impede their progress on the upward path. What are the main faults stopping one's progress? Answer. All right. Let us have a look at some of these faults. Undoubtedly, all of you can look at faults in a spirit of scientific detachment, because all of you who are reading this are either on the way to eliminating those faults, if you have not already done so. We must take a look at faults as well as at virtues. After all, doctors look at dead bodies and dissect them so that they may be enlightened and educated by the faults and the corruptions which they find in those dead bodies. One of the worst faults is that of scandal. Scandal is the sabotage of the soul. Not the victim's soul, mind you, but the one who starts and continues the scandal. People love scandal. People just love to say things which will reduce to ashes the good character of another person. And if there's no truth in it, it makes them feel even better. It's as if to say, "I'm as good as he is. Why should he get away with everything? He must have some fault somewhere." It is a case that in some countries one cannot be sued for libel or slander if one is telling lies, but only if one is repeating the truth. So people like scandal. They like, by words, to injure those who they have not the courage to attack physically. Scandal, lying rumor, is an insidious, evil attack on one's own soul, because in repeating tittle-tattle and making up rumors and lies, the person perpetrating such things definitely injures his own electrical charges, which is the same as taking poison, which attacks one's own soul. Perjury is another vice which injures the perjurer even far more than the one who is perjured. People hear a little bit of rumor, a little bit of scandal, but it's not enough. It's not dirty enough, so a little bit is added to make it worse, and then it is passed on as fact to some other person who adds a bit more. That again injures the utterer's soul. Frequently, jealousy, another great vice, is the cause of rumor. One man simply cannot bear the sight of another. One man is absolutely jealous of the imagined successes of another, and so he works to cut that man down to size. He starts a whispering campaign, or he damns with faint praise. It is a fact, you know, that one can injure a person terribly by saying, "Well, I suppose he did his best after all. We must give him credit for that." Then such a person, to the superficial hearer, gets a reputation as being a reasonable man and praising even under the most difficult circumstances. Another vice is greed. Greed is akin to jealousy. Mr. X is terribly jealous of the success of Mr. Y. Mr. X is greedy for money. Money hunger, it is called in some countries, and the greed feeds the jealousy, and the more jealous Mr. X becomes, the more greedy he becomes. All this is deadly poison to the soul, for the soul is a very real thing, as you should know by now. When we indulge in scandal or perjury or give way to greed or jealousy, we're making opposition charges to our soul, and that can really hurt us. Nirvana is the elimination of things like jealousy and greed and scandal, etc., and the best way to progress is to remember, "Do unto others as you would have them do unto you." Question. I understand that people can pick up a stone, a cigarette case, or a handkerchief, and they can obtain impressions about the owner of such things. How is this done? Answer. You are referring to psychometry, which is receiving tactile impressions, which, in an occult part of the brain, are transformed into pictures or visions. Now, you may wonder how it is possible to pick up any impressions from an inanimate object, but let us make it clearer by giving a simple little illustration. Supposing a person has been holding a coin in his hand, then the coin will gain warmth from the person's hand. And if that coin be placed upon a table with other coins, you would have no difficulty at all in detecting which of the coins had been held. It would be the one that had some warmth to it. This is just a physical thing, but it will show you that there are impressions. If you want to try psychometry, you should first of all retire to your sanctum or meditation room. You should start off as if you're going to meditate, but then you should pick up the object whose history you desire to know. Pick it up in the left hand and let it rest lightly on the palm of the left hand. Try to let your mind become blank or receptive. You may feel that you don't know what you are looking for. You do not know what to expect. You just do not know how to proceed. Well, sit there and just do nothing. Imagine that you have a big black square in front of you, and you're going to see pictures appear on that big black square. First of all, you will receive impressions rather than pictures. You may receive an impression that a person is unhappy or that the person is happy. You may get vague glimpses of some particular surroundings which clearly are not your surroundings. First of all, you'll be inclined to doubt that you're receiving anything. But keep that article wrapped up when you are not using it, so that others cannot touch it, and practice with it. You will have to make repeated attempts at that same article before you can realize how much is imagination and how much is psychometric power. Do this several times. Do it every night for a week, and you will find at the end of the week that you have certain definite conclusions about the article. If after some minutes you fail to get any impressions at all about the article, put it either to the left or right side of your temple. If that doesn't work, put it at the back of your head, just where your head joins your neck. It could easily be that you are by nature left-handed, and in that case use your right hand instead of the left. But the main thing is to experiment with different positions. Left hand, right temple or back of the head. Then you just let your mind go blank and try to draw into your mind the impressions which are being transmitted by the object. Remember that when you see a stone in the road or a bird in the sky, your eyes are not reaching up to that bird or reaching down to that stone. What you do receive is an impression or vibration transmitted by the stone or the bird in this particular case, though you get impressions which you call sight. In psychometry, where you also receive impressions, you go deeper than the surface, and so you get your visual sensations inside the occult part of the brain. It's quite a simple matter with practice. The best way to practice is to get a person whom you truly like to pick up a stone from the beach and wash it carefully with running water. Then the person holds the stone to his or her forehead and thinks strongly a message to you, such as, "I picked up this stone on Monday," or whatever the day is. Then the person carefully wraps the stone in tissue paper and gives it to you without touching it anymore. If you practice things like that, you will soon see that psychometry works. Question. You are not a Christian. You are not one brought up to the Bible. So what do you think of the Bible? Answer. Well, you have to remember, to start with, that the Bible was written many, many years after the actual events related. Further, the Bible has been translated and mistranslated and retranslated many, many times. The great priest so-and-so demanded a new translation, then someone else came along with a fresh translation, and then King James I or somebody decided that he would have an authorized translation. Through all of this, though, there is a great strain of truth, because the real truths never die. They can be concealed to a certain extent, but to the discerning, the truths are always there. In the matter of the Bible, there are strange records written in the mystery languages of prehistoric ages, but you cannot always take the Bible at its actual face value. You would not take the actual black and white letters precisely as they were written. You cannot interpret them literally. You have to use symbology. The Bible is an esoteric book, and of course it is connected with the Indian, Chaldean, and Egyptian systems of symbology. Christ went to Tibet, and after passing through India and studying Indian religions, he actually went and studied in Tibet and came back to the Western world with the religion basically of the East, but which had been altered to suit the West. If you doubt this, remember that if you study the Indian systems, you will find that all the glyphs and numbers are to be found in the Indian systems, and if only these wretched scientists would have a correct reading of the Bible, bearing in mind anthropology, ethnology, chronology, physiology, and all of that, they would have a very much greater understanding of all that there was in history, for the Bible is a most invaluable aid, if you can read it correctly, to what went on in bygone ages. Before one can read the Bible, one has to know all about the Chaldean hierophants, from which one gets the knowledge of the Kabbalah. If you will carefully study the first five books of the Old Testament, you will find that they are actually legends, and they are quite a useful dissertation on philosophical phases of world cosmogony. Everyone knows the story of Moses and how he was found in the bulrushes by the Pharaoh's daughter. Well, it may interest you to know that all this happened about 1,000 years before, because there are certain tiles known as the Babylonian tiles which give the story of King Sargon. He lived a long time before Moses, a very long time before Moses, about 1,000 years before, actually. And this story about a baby boy being found in the bulrushes was the story of King Sargon. The book of Exodus was not written by Moses, as has been generally believed, but instead was made up from various prior sources by Ezra. And in connection with this, the book of Job is the oldest in the Hebrew system, and certainly dates long before Moses. Furthermore, any of the great Bible stories, such as creation, the fall of man, the blaming of women, the flood, and the Tower of Babel, were all written long before the time of Moses. These stories are actually rewritten versions of what archaeologists know as the Chaldean tablets. The Jews obtained their first ideas about creation from Moses, and Moses got his ideas about creation from the Egyptians, and the whole affair, which is taken from the Chaldo-Arcadian accounts, was rewritten by Ezra. You will find that God is the Logos. You will also find that the Bible actually starts with a mistranslation where it says, "In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth." It was not the actual physical earth that was referred to, but the upper and the lower, the visible and the invisible. There are a lot of discrepancies in the Bible. For example, consider the first part of Genesis. God said, "Let there be firmaments." And a second god obeyed and made the firmaments. The first god said, "Let there be light," and the second god made some light, from which it is clear that God commands some other god, who must have been a lesser god, because he did the bidding of the first. Let there be light does not mean daylight or sunlight or artificial light. It means instead spiritual light. It means lift the soul of man out of darkness that he may perceive the greatness of God. Again, Adam was not the first man created. The Bible tells us that because in Genesis 4:16-17, it is said that Cain went into the land of Moab with the intention of buying a wife. Now, if Adam was the first man created, what was the point of Cain going into Moab in search of a wife? Because there just wouldn't be any. Actually, Adam is a composite of 10 Sephiroth. And of course, the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost is the three of the upper triad of the archetype world, while the second Adam is an esoteric composition who represents the seven groups of men, the seven groups of mankind, and which thus formed the first human root race. There were the Atlanteans, who made a lot of researches, and if you will read the Bible properly, esoterically that is, you will find that the seven keys, which open the mysteries of the seven great root races, can be traced back to Atlantean times. So the Egyptians obtained information from the Atlanteans. The Jews obtained information from the Egyptians and altered it a bit. And then the Christians came along and they took all that information and distorted it quite considerably. And then the translators who put it into Latin softened all sorts of comments and made them fit in with the new Christian ideas and ideals, just as nowadays politicians alter history to suit their own country. I shall have something more to say about religion later in this chapter, but that is enough about the Bible for now. Question: do you believe in the Garden of Eden? Write to me and tell me what you think the Garden of Eden really means. Answer: in the answer to the question above, I blithely stated that we were finished with the Bible for the time being. Well, we have to open it again to answer this question, which is, do I believe the tale about the Garden of Eden? Do I believe about the fall of Adam and Eve, and that it was caused by their newfound interest in the difference between each other's bodies? In other words, as I read the question, do I think that sex has been the ruination of mankind? No, of course I don't. I think all that is rubbish. In the time of Pope Gregory, often referred to as Pope Gregory the Great, the vast Palatine library containing many of the original manuscripts was destroyed. Some of the manuscripts were original papyri, and they went back to almost the date of the start of Christianity. The library was destroyed. The Pope of those days thought that men were learning too much, and if men learned more than the priests wanted them to know, they would be a danger to the priests, in that they would be asking questions which the priests found it difficult to answer. Pope Gregory thought that men should start out again without benefits of the writings of other people. He also had an idea that the moment was opportune to rewrite the history of Christianity and edit it in such a way that the power of the priests was not diminished. So the libraries were burned, priceless manuscripts were lost to the average man and woman. Some of those manuscripts, in duplicate form, had been hidden in caves in other parts of the world, but to those who can read the Akashic Record, all manuscripts, all knowledge is always available. In the case of Adam and Eve, we must remember that so-called original sin was not sex. It was not anything at all to do with the physical body, but was an abstract thing. The original sin was pride, false pride, an inferior people setting up as the equal of the gods. Man, and of course woman, thought that they were the equal of the gods, and so they rebelled against the gods. The Garden of Eden was the young earth, the earth which was only then becoming fitted to be the home of a new race, the race of man. You will appreciate that there have been many races upon the earth, many forms of life. Before man, as we know him now, appeared on this earth, there was another race similar to man, not shaggy apes as has been popularly supposed, but a completely different type of person upon completely different continents of the earth. Continents which have long sunk beneath the surface of the ocean so that other continents could rise and other nations could rise with them. These people were different. They had somewhat different anatomical features, which we need not go into on this occasion. Their skin was purple, and they were rather larger and rather taller than humans of the present day. These people were intelligent, too intelligent for their own good, perhaps, and they were the ones who lived in the so-called Garden of Eden. According to ancient records, Earth is a colony which was populated by people from far beyond this universe. At the time of the Garden of Eden, some of the people, the overseers, came to this Earth to supervise the new race of man, the purple people. And the overseers were giants, according to man's perceptions. They were, in fact, half as big again as the people of the earth, and so we have a racial memory of the days when gods, giants, walked upon the earth. The overseers, who, after all, were only humans of a different kind, fraternized rather too freely with the purple people of the earth, and they became altogether too friendly, and the inferior people of the earth had inflated ideas of their own importance. They thought that if the gods associated with them, they must be wonderful. And so they were impressed with the strange weapons and devices of the gods. They were impressed with the boxes which showed pictures and produced voices and music out of the air. And they plotted and schemed whereby they could overthrow the gods, the overseers, and obtain those devices for themselves. Strange vehicles known as the chariots of the gods flamed across the sky by day and night. The gods were busy seeing about the new earth, seeing about the welfare of the people of the new earth, but they still had time to fraternize with the people. A scheme was concocted whereby one young lady who was particularly attractive to the overseers should make herself even more attractive to one particular overseer. And the plan was that, while the gods were otherwise engaged, one might say, the men would kill the gods. The gods became aware of the plot. They became aware that mankind was very, very faulty. they became aware that mankind had treacherous thoughts, lusted after power, had pride, false pride. And so, mankind was driven away from that particularly pleasant spot. In other words, they were driven out of the Garden of Eden by angels with flaming swords. Now just think, supposing a savage who had never seen a jet plane saw one of these things going across the sky, roaring like a blowtorch, wouldn't it be a chariot of the gods? Supposing he saw a gun which was being fired, he saw smoke and perhaps a bit of flame coming out of the barrel, couldn't that be a flaming sword? He would have to call it something, and he wouldn't know about revolvers. A flaming sword is good enough. It got down through the history books and all that. In the course of time, the natural evolution of the earth caused earthquakes and tremors, caused continents to sink and continents to rise. Most of the people of the earth were destroyed in various catastrophes and calamities, but certain people were refugees and they escaped to high land. Certain of them, in fact, lived on through their racial memories. For instance, have you ever seen a native of darkest Africa who was not black, but almost a purplish black? Think of that. You will agree that there are already at least three races on this earth: the black people, the yellow people, and the white people. They are three different races, and there is quite a lot of discord among them. A racial discord, as if each one thinks that the other one is an intruder. So we come back to the Garden of Eden, and we find that when the gods walked upon the earth, they were kind and considerate. They were not gods, of course, but the overseers from right out of this universe. Humans tried to take advantage of them, and the original sin of humans was not sex, which is a natural function of humans, but pride and rebellion. Of course, the church in the time of Pope Gregory, and in fact many times in the church's history, had a great phobia against sex. They had no phobia against pride. So, because it suited their purpose, they said that the fall of man was through woman. The fall of man was because woman tempted him with sex. Woman was the sinner, the temptress, the offender, every time. There is nothing in the Bible, nor in true Christian belief, which supports the statement that man's fall was through sex. Christ himself was never opposed to women. He never thought that woman was an inferior creature to be treated as a dog or worse. Saint Augustine and many others took advantage of the rewriting of the Bible to preach even more and more violently against sex. Augustine was one of those who was terribly, terribly opposed to sex, even in marriage. It is perhaps worth a thought here that there is no great opponent of drink than the reformed drunkard, and there is no greater opponent of vice, so-called, than the person who has been reformed from vice. End of chapter 11.